By way of introduction, I'm Sarah White, a retired director of pharmacy with a continued emphasis in effective leadership. The purpose of this conversation with a very successful person is to learn from their experience and be more influential ourselves. I would like to welcome Billy W. Woodward. By way of brief introduction, Billy received his pharmacy education at the University of Texas at Austin. He has held pharmacy leadership positions at Methodist Hospital in Lubbock, Texas, as Director of Pharmacy, Central Supply, and Materials Management, and as Executive Director of Pharmacy at Scott & White Health System in Temple, Texas. After retiring, Billy has worked for Ernst & Young and is now president of his own consulting firm, Renaissance Innovative Pharmacy Services. Welcome. Billy, share your story about how you chose pharmacy, and after working a couple of years in retail, how you get into hospital pharmacy.
Well, Sarah, it's kind of an interesting but long story. I actually worked at a local drugstore in a small town, and so I had sort of an affinity for that, and I had a big interest in science, as you had, and so I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to go in some field of medicine or pharmacy or something. So I was also rather poor at that stage of the game, so I felt like if I went to pharmacy school, I had at least a way I could work my way through veterinary school or medicine or whatever. So I was thinking in those terms from day one. As far as the transition to hospital, I actually came out of UT Austin and worked 2 years in retail. And I was actually on my way to medical school. I had been accepted in medical school and was married at the time, and our second child came along rather quickly. And so I had to postpone my entry into medical school and spent another year in practice. And at that point, I actually met a gentleman in Rotary Club who was administrator of Methodist Hospital. So from that intro, I went over and looked at the job he had open at the time, which was about a 300-bed tertiary care hospital, and thought, hey, I can figure this thing out. So I actually was hired at the ripe old age of 23 to be director of pharmacy at Methodist Hospital in Lubbock, having had no previous experience.
So as that new director, how did you know what you needed to do? Because as you mentioned, you didn't really have the benefit of a residency or an advanced degree.
Right. Well, a couple of things. First of all, back in those days, in the olden days, if you will, you know, the practice of health system pharmacy wasn't where it is today, so there wasn't as many residencies around the country. I don't know. I think Leo Godley had one in Texas, and that was about it. So when I decided to make this move, I thought, well, I'll try it another year because I need to work another year before I went to medical school. And I actually got the names of some prominent health system pharmacists around the country who were doing progressive practice. Leo Godley actually sat down with me and mentored me with this list. And so I proceeded to go to ASHP that first spring in Boston to a general institute and met everybody I could there. And then I took that list and actually went to see people that were doing, at that point in time, early days of unit dose were coming into fruition. And I knew I wanted to do that at Methodist. So I went to see Paul Parker at Kentucky, and I went to see Bill Heller at Arkansas, and I went to see Cliff Latchelet at Ohio State. So I made the rounds and was just, I guess, forward enough to ask these folks if I could come see what they were doing. And so the net result of that was an early on mentorship that I sort of created. I created my own residency, if you will, came back with those ideas and began to try to figure out how to do it at Methodist in Lubbock, which we did for several years until I left there, actually. Put a lot of those same concepts and ideas into practice at Methodist.
Could people do that today, even though it's a bigger profession?
I think so. You know, it's difficult because of the size of meetings now to interact at the level that I had the fortune to act, because I was able to meet everybody that was anybody almost at these general institutes, which usually had between 60 and 120 people at them. So over a period of 4 or 5 days, if you were willing, you could meet everybody there. And so that's harder today with the size of the mid-year and even the annual meeting. But I think you could still do it. You just have to take that list and go forward and take the ball and run with it. So I don't think it's not as easy, but it's certainly possible.
And one unique aspect of your services at Methodist was medication administration under pharmacy. Talk a little bit about how that functioned and why you got into that.
Well, when I made those trips, I actually looked at Paul Parker's operation at Kentucky, and he had a centralized unit dose system, which was very efficient. So I wanted the efficiency of Paul's operation. But when I talked to Cliff at Ohio State, he was doing a technician program, if you remember at the time, where they administered meds to patients there at Ohio State. Also, I had talked to Phil Shaneman and his team up at Providence in Seattle, and they were doing a nurse version of unit dose and administration. So I came back to Lubbock and said, oh, I want to do an efficient centralized unit dose system, but I want to pair it with a version of med administration. And in Texas, at least, there was no way to do that with technicians legally, but I felt like I could take vocational nurses, train them up to be what we call them pharmacy nurses, and actually train them to administer meds. So when we went on to a unit and flipped a 60-bed unit to unit dose and full pharmacy medication administration, we did it in one swift move, and we were 24/7 responsible for all the meds. And that model we did for 8.5 years till I left there. We had about 96 nurses, all LVNs, LPNs, depending on where you're from. We called them pharmacy nurses, and again, we made them nurse specialists, and they loved their job. There was a lot of job satisfaction, and even to this day, since I've left there, I still think that was the best system I've had to get the right med to the patient.
Well, you brought up Ohio State, and I was at Ohio State for my residency, and what I found, it was a really tight system because as the clinical pharmacist, if the patient was off the unit and missed a dose, it was the pharmacist that made the judgment how to make that dose up.
Right.
And then I'm sure in your system, as we did, at the end of the shift, we made sure all the scheduled meds were charted or the reason charted not. So it, at least in my experience, it really was a tight and excellent system.
Yeah, it really was our experience as well. In fact, we had them come down to Central Pharmacy and actually check their own carts. They checked it with the technician that was filling. And so when they left there, they knew they had what they needed. So some of the handoff challenges that I've hence seen in other systems that I've been involved in didn't happen because, first of all, they were a pharmacy employee. Secondly, they were really schooled on what was important and what their priorities were.
So you didn't have to chase missing doses as much?
Not as much. It was amazing. And it was amazing the efficiency of it, actually. Like I said, we had one nurse usually doing PRNs and one doing schedules for 60 patients, which was considerably more efficient than the old model.
And when you were at Methodist, you had other responsibilities, like a chief pharmacy officer today. Why don't you tell us the other areas and what are the pros and cons of doing that?
Yeah, over a period of time till I left there, we actually added central supply, we call it central services, materials management, receiving departments. And so the good of that was I think pharmacy was elevated in the eyes of the administration and in the system because we were no longer a single clinical department. The bad news was I think to some degree it sort of pulled me a lot of different directions. And so in retrospect, I would do it all over again because of the learning experience. But I think I was a little bit concerned, particularly toward the end, that I was getting so far away from pharmacy with some of the, and they usually gave me departments that were in trouble. So the ones that I got were usually ones that had issues when I got there. So I think probably in retrospect, in fact, when I went from there on, I actually decided to not take a VP job or whatever downstream. Because I didn't want to get that far away from pharmacy. But it was a great experience, particularly for nursing. I learned so much about nursing practice that I had no knowledge of before.
And so after 13 years at Methodist, you left. Talk a little bit about that scenario, because I think it's a good teaching moment for others.
It is. I was, again, very loyal employee till the day I left there and was very proud with what we had done there. We had gotten a fair amount of notoriety for our med nurse program and for what we were doing. So I was, and yet I still had a lot of things left to do. And there were really a couple of reasons I left. First of all, there was a political sort of move, if you will, among nursing to take over the 96 nurses that I had working for me. And we had 8.5 years of record, basically, of doing a good job. We had proven our point with our stats. And so I was disturbed that that was going on, or it looked like that coup, if you will, was going to happen. The other thing was I was approaching administration regularly asking for more clinical resources because even though we had a good distribution system, the next piece of the puzzle that we absolutely had to do was clinical practice. And my bosses were looking and saying, well, we don't know why we need anything else because you guys are getting all this publicity around the country. You're going and speaking. And why in the world do we need any more resources? So I felt like the combination of the nurse team threat that I was facing, as well as the fact that it looked like they weren't going to give me the sources to move my practice in my department to that level clinically.
It's kind of the courage of your convictions. Do you regret that at all?
No, I don't. In fact, I see in my own practice and I see in my consulting practice in recent years, I think there's a time to hold them and a time to fold them. And unfortunately, because pharmacists are pretty much solid citizens, we often stay when we ought to go. And I'm not proposing that we should change jobs without a lot of reflection, but I also believe that bad practice sometimes is tolerated because we're willing to stay on. And most of the time, if that's the case, then you do need to move on.
And so you went then to Scott and White, and you developed, as I reflect on your career, the continuum of care in terms of the ambulatory and pharmacy benefit management. Talk about all of that, because that was pretty unique in the time frame that you were doing. And what sort of dates were those kind of?
I went to Scott and White in 1978. Okay. I left there in 2003. So that 25-year span was, there was a lot of things going on. And, part of the reason I went to Scott and White, there were two or three definite reasons. One, I knew they needed a clinical program and they would be willing to support it. But they also were a group model medical practice, a very old traditional group model medical practice. So I felt like I could get in a system where I could align with the physician on the same team, as opposed to when I was at Methodist in Lubbock, we had 750 physicians all in private practice. And it was, virtually like the old herding cats challenge. And so I felt like if the physicians worked for the same organization I did, I could make a better case to them for what pharmacy practice needed to be. The other thing was it was a large system with a clinic and a big ambulatory piece of the puzzle, as well as a health plan. So I felt like it also gave me a greater theater, if you would, to work within for pharmacy practice, because at that point in time there was almost no ambulatory practice going on in pharmacy there. So I felt like the field was wide open, the opportunities were great, and the medical staff support was there.
So how did you prioritize with so many opportunities available? How does one prioritize that?
Well, as good an institution as Scott and White was in 1978, its pharmacy department was about a 1950 vintage. So that was a heck of a challenge because I had to figure out what do I do first, much like I did at Methodist. And so you sit down and you figure out what do I have to do first. I, first of all, had to get their finances in order because I knew I could probably get support for everything else if I could get the bottom line looking better, and there were so many areas that you could do that very easily. So I spent a little bit of time up front figuring that out and getting befriending the CFO, if you will, and that sort of laid the groundwork then for the other things. And then we went to basic distribution, unit dose distribution, intravenous admixture programs, and then began an early phase of clinical practice. And from that, we expanded further into clinical practice. Then we moved over to ambulatory care, started clinical practice in the clinics. We also pushed out a pharmacy and put it under the health plan as a managed care closed pharmacy. And then over the years, we expanded that to a network of pharmacies owned by the health plan. So I guess in a sense, what I did was take first things first as far as what were essentially financial issues as well as patient safety issues, and then move out from that to get to the areas that we felt like could really improve care ultimately in terms of the total model. So sort of doing the next right thing, in each stage of the game, if I didn't understand it, which sometimes, for example, managed care, of course, that was the early days of managed care as well. There weren't a lot of people running around practicing managed care, so there wasn't any place to go do that other than sort of jump in and learn it yourself and self-educate. And so it was a combination in those areas of educating myself and continual learning, as well as hiring in people, if there were people, that knew more than I knew, which was often the case, and putting them in responsible positions, treating them right, and letting them practice and show me how we needed to do that.
So you had programs like infusion centers and home infusion. And why don't you talk a little bit about those and pharmacy benefit management?
Right. Yeah, we had, we had the whole ball game. We had home infusion. We had an IV admixture program centrally. Then we had an IV team. We moved into the clinics and actually started putting pharmacists in. We started an anticoagulation clinic. That was our first major clinic. And then we got into primary care, diabetes, women's health. And so we put clinics, pharmacy-based clinics, in all these operations, both in the central campus as well as the multi-clinic campuses around the central Texas. And so in each of those, we were, again, pushing the limits of pharmacy. In the late, the late 80s, the health plan had grown considerably and was becoming a dominant force in the Scott & White structure, and they had no pharmacy program. So almost overnight, they approached me and said, you know, could you help us with pharmacy there? So we started a closed pharmacy, and we put it in an old hospital that we owned downtown. And that thing actually grew dramatically very quickly, and within 6 months, the health plan took on the state of Texas employees as a group, and it was about 25 or 30,000 members. So it was a big financial piece of the puzzle. But we had 90 days to put together a benefit plan for that group. That was to put the network in place. And so what we did was I said, well, I think I can figure out how to do that. So I had a 90-day challenge to actually put together a network of 60 pharmacies beyond just Scott & White. We were doing all the maintenance drug refills in our own pharmacy and mailing out those refills to members. So we were able to keep a lot of clinical and financial control and yet use the local pharmacies in the region for first doses. So again, we just sort of pushed out and figured out, you know, what do we do next? What do we do right? And again, I was busily going around, even in AMCP and that whole organization, meeting people and interacting with people that knew more about managed care pharmacy than I did, so that I could develop the same kind of network at that stage of my practice that I'd done years before with ASHP and health system practice.
Why don't you enlarge a little bit on what AMC is as you mentioned, how you utilized it?
Yeah, it's the Academy of Managed Care Pharmacy, and it actually started out as interesting. It's sort of a parallel with ASHP. It started out as an appendage sort of ASHP, and they met actually in conjunction with the convention facilities and all those things that they sort of linked to ASHP, and they grew rather rapidly to the point that they eventually moved out on their own. So they're now on their own as an organization, and they're much smaller than we are, but they're a very focused organization of pharmacists. They have two educational meetings a year. They've been very successful. They started out with pretty ragged CE and now are doing a very good job at managed care CE. So the whole, almost a parallel to a small ASHP is what they did in the managed care arena.
At Scott & White, you had a wide span of control. How did you develop a leadership team to assist with that?
A couple of things. Again, if it was an area that I had a comfort level, I sort of did it internally, much like we do in our normal department, where I was grooming people to move into leadership positions. On the other hand, if I had nobody on my staff who was really competent, including me, then I usually went outside and got the best expertise I could to sort of bring it in-house and teach us. So it was a combination of that. But the interesting thing was the diversity of that model allowed me to take talented people that maybe I couldn't have afforded or kept in the acute care arena, and I could move them in both clinical positions and operational positions into positions in these new arenas. And if they were, you know, creative and they were energetic and they were good sound leaders, they were perfect. And so some of those went on to be very specialized individual leaders in their own practice areas, and not only did they help us, but they became very successful in various areas from managed care to ambulatory practice.
Why don't you talk a little bit about how to develop somebody?
You know, that's almost an art form, I think. In fact, I think I changed my mind a little bit, in fact, probably a lot over the years as a leader trying to figure out how to groom people to move to their level of highest capability. And you know, at one point, I think I envisioned that I could sort of press everybody through a mold and get what I felt was the walking, talking best health system leader I could find. And I began to realize that that model didn't work all that well. And so I think I began to realize that to run a good department took a diverse group of talents and capabilities and even philosophies, as long as it's consistent with our practice philosophy and our patient care objectives. So I began to figure out how to take round pegs, if you would, and put them into round holes, but not have to insist that everybody be a round peg. And out of that, I think we became a much stronger department. People were happier. I wasn't straining trying to get everybody to see the world as I saw it. And, you know, I think that's some of just maturing as a leader to see that and to understand that. And it also ends up with a lot happier work environment because you're putting people in positions that they can succeed. And it's very infectious, too, because if these folks see a colleague that's put into an area or assigned to a specific responsibility and they're successful and they're rewarded for it and they're happy, then these folks are a lot more likely to be willing to do that themselves.
And I kind of had the same learning. You sort of begin to play to people's strengths.
Right.
And then they perform at their maximum.
Absolutely. And again, it's an art form, I decided, not a science. So that's the part of our job that's definitely reading people.
Correct. One of the things that is common these days is the 340B. Would you kind of talk a little bit about what that's all about, how one qualifies for 340B, what's the advantage?
Sure.
Because I think we throw that term around, and I'm not sure anybody, unless they really are doing it, totally understands it.
Sure, I'll be glad to do that. You know, actually, when I was at Scott & White, I kept pushing administration and accounting to figure out if we were 340B qualified. And up until the day I left there in 03, we were not. But what qualifies you as an institution is your charity load. And it's based on a disproportionate share of charity in your patient population. And there's a formulary, a very precise formulary to be able to make that determination. Well, what that does, if you qualify, it allows you to buy outpatient, not inpatient, but outpatient drugs at PHS pricing, which is basically government pricing. And so it's a significant, anywhere from 40 to 60% discount versus what even with a very competitive GPO contract that you can get. So what it brings to the table is for an institution to be able to buy for its outpatients, again, at that competitive level. So it's a really, really strong program. It was actually started in 1992 in some fine print that actually was titled 340B. It had to do with the VA pricing and a bunch of details there. So that's how far it goes back, 1992.
Thank you. You provided at Scott & White pharmacy student experiences, residencies, and fellowships. Why spend that kind of time?
You know, one of my passions was the educational piece, and again, that's all intertwined, I think, with developing leaders as well. And so, yeah, we had 50 or 60 acute care undergraduate rotations. We had 13 residents and fellows each year, and we've had, I think, since then about 190 graduates from that program over the last 10 or 12 years. And what I saw with that was, one thing, I think it brings a level of intellectual curiosity and intellectual fervor, if you will, that brings to the organization that you can't get with just daily operational challenges, even if you're doing good clinical practice. So it brings that element of quest for learning, quest for knowledge. It brings you the challenging students that come in that will challenge you, and I assure you they will. And at the same time, it created a pipeline for us of folks who wanted to stay around with us, who knew our system already, that we could put into strategic places, both leadership and staff. So it had an incredible amount of side benefits, if you will. It is a lot of work, but again, it's one of the things that probably, since I've been gone from Scott & White, that I miss most is that student interaction.
You were a speaker at the PPMI, the Pharmacy Practice Model Initiative. Discuss your message to the audience.
My message was implementing the challenges and opportunities of implementing practice model in a changing environment. And what I tried to do with that was talk about four things that I think in my own practice model experience, which is really kind of what all of our experience has been for our careers, four things. The first of those was to essentially have a positive strategy for taking negative things and turning them into positive things. And I had a laundry list of those, and you would recognize those. Things like the financial challenge, you know, take that and mold that into a financial advantage for the model. And so, and the second thing was to actually pick up on synergistic movements out there. For example, the quality movement is huge, as you know. And if you can link your practice model to that and show return on investment and show change in patient outcomes, again, you got the synergy of being able to do that. The third thing is actually confronting our demons, if you will. I think I call them the untouchables. And it's things like the tremendous gap between our clinical staff and our distributive central pharmacy staff in many operations. And that's been something that's been out there for 20 or 25 years. And we worked really hard at Scott and White to tackle that. But it's also one of those things that's almost unspoken. And if this model, and I think most of us are advocating an integrated model that combines clinical practice with some distribution responsibilities, if that's really going to work, we've got to address that gap, and we've got to do it in a way that pulls that together and that we don't have one group of pharmacists on one side of the fence and another on the other side. Other examples are the leadership gap that I think we have in our clinical model. And when I was preparing for this lecture, it kind of came clear to me. But the difficulty I've seen is in the clinical world for the last 25 years, clinicians, for the most part, and again, I realize there are exceptions, have avoided leadership positions. In fact, they've almost preached against anything to do with management or leadership. At the same time, the significant leaders in the profession have often come through practice trails or journeys that haven't prepared them as very good clinicians. And so they've often not quite been willing to step up and learn to be a clinician leader. And meanwhile, the clinician has refused to be a clinician leader. And so we've ended up with this gap, which is really no wonder after 25 years or more of clinical practice that we don't have a model developed. And so, again, that's one of those untouchable areas that I think we have to address. I think the level of clinical expertise in the rank-and-file pharmacist is another unspoken issue that we don't talk about. And again, I realize there are exceptions to this, but I think it's a mile wide and a half inch deep, as we say in Texas, in terms of we've got a level of clinical knowledge, but not enough to step out and truly move into a clinical team with a level of competence and efficiency and assuredness that they need to practice. So again, those are just some examples of those untouchables. The fourth area that I mentioned, which I think is probably the most significant of all of them, is I think we have to look at the practice model in a totally different way. And by that, I mean it's a different paradigm, even from the one that most of us practice in throughout our career, and that is it's a model that has to be integrated with the rest of the patient care team. This can't be a pharmacy-owned, even if we're great clinicians, we're great distributors of medications, and we're safe and accurate and all those things. The model I envision has to be integrated into the overall patient care team. So what does that mean? That means we have to rethink that, and we no longer can go behind closed doors and figure out how to do distribution and even go up and go on a unit and do our thing in clinical practice without integrating those processes into the overall patient care team. So I think virtually changing that model to be a much broader scope of practice with a whole different vision is what we have to do. And that's probably the hardest, because that's the biggest leap from where most of us, even those that have been fairly successful, have come. We've been able to look at these other pieces, do them quite well. But suddenly now we're talking about this huge model that has to be integrated into the rest of the world. We've got to get nursing to accept this. We've got to get the medical staff to accept it. We have to figure out how to integrate it into that overall team, as well as integrating our own team internally. So again, that new model. And that then takes a different kind of leader. You know, it's a different kind of leader who can work in the pharmacy and lead the team to mix IVs or to do unit dose distribution or all the other things that we've learned to do quite well, I think. Suddenly, this leader has to figure out how to interact with physicians, nurses, administrators, and sell a vision to that larger patient team of a different level of practice. And that's probably the biggest challenge, selling the vision that they can't see for themselves until you can get out there and practice it. And yet you can't get out there and practice it until they can see it.
So given the current situation, how long do we have to figure this out, in your view?
Well, you know, I don't think we have very long. I think we're way behind. I think we've got a lot of the pieces of the puzzle, And I think if we as a profession, as well as us as leaders and practitioners, can see it, all we have to do is connect the dots. I think we got the pieces, but I think we have to connect the dots in this bigger vision, this different paradigm. But we got to see it pretty quick. And I think we have to look differently at our leadership skills, because the leadership skills necessary to lead this kind of team are dramatically different than leading an internal pharmacy team.
So where would somebody get those skills?
Those different leadership skills?
Correct.
Well, I think, it's a process of self-education again to a great degree, but I think you start by stepping outside the pharmacy and making yourself part of the rest of the hospital world in this case. And when you do that, you're suddenly in a different ballgame. So I think us as leaders, have to be willing to step out there, take a risk, get outside of our comfort zone, and actually being in that environment to have to interact with those other individuals. At the same time, the self-study skills we've talked about, things like the PLA now that we're using it at the foundation, are all tools that I think can help us do that and help us to be more of a people leader than a product leader, which is what we were in the past. But I think it's, again, this matter of self-discipline, self-education, and the willingness to take a risk.
And you mentioned the PLA and the foundation, and you've served on the ASHP Board of Directors. You've been a president of the Texas Society. You've chaired the ASHP Foundation Board. Talk a little bit about what the ASHP Foundation is and what it does.
You know, the foundation is a separate body from ASHP, and yet it sort of runs parallel to ASHP, and its entire focus is education and research. ASHP, as you know, focuses on practice and education of practitioners. The ASHP Foundation actually sets out there and essentially gathers funds, both from private individuals, hopefully pharmacists, as well as industry, to put together everything from grants to education programs to the website to white papers to initiatives at various things like the Leadership Institute every year. All those things that are pieces of the puzzle that practitioners that are in the trenches have to have available to them, and yet it's not a direct role of ASHP per se. It also allows us, and going back to the origin of it, allows us to have a different tax status as an organization to funnel funds appropriately into this body that can then be used appropriately for things without having to pay taxes on.
Yeah. So if a pharmacist contributes, which we hope everyone does, you can take that as a charitable contribution.
Absolutely, and I think if there's a takeaway message, I think everybody needs to be as supportive of the foundation as they are ASHP. And when I was on the board as well as the chair of the board for 2 years, that was part of Steve Allen. My goal was to get more individuals involved, both with the foundation, whether it was a grant or an educational program or the awards program for excellence in medication safety, all those things, get people involved in them. At the same time, get them to pony up some of their own money to be able to support that. And again, I think as a competent, conscientious professional, we have a responsibility to do that just like we do to our local communities and churches.
And talk a little bit about the Pharmacy Leadership Academy, since you're a teacher, a professor in that.
Yes, I will. That's actually an online course that we teach, and I think we're about to start our fourth year of that. It actually involves a series of 9 modules that essentially look at all the different phases of leadership excellence necessary for a practitioner or a young leader or even a mid-career leader or even an experienced leader to learn from individuals like myself and the other faculty. And it's a very disciplined program approach. It's a home study approach. It now has a link with a degree program that you can actually get a lot of college credit as well. But the result of that is we want to see more practitioners having these leadership skills, including that larger paradigm that we talked about for the practice model, that we have more people out there with the leadership skills than teaching other people. But it's probably the most efficient way I know of to get yourself up to speed if you have any inclination to be a leader.
It's common for people who are elected to ASHP board to go on and be ASHP president. Talk a little bit about why you chose not to do that.
You know, it was all a timing issue, I suppose. As I was coming off the board was when I transitioned from Methodist in Lubbock to Scott and White. And so I had a brand new job. The year or two that I would have been probably most likely to have run was the years when I was just starting the program at Scott & White, which was, again, a very big, monstrous challenge because they had so far to go. At the same time, my two older children were just going into high school, and so the travel requirements at that point in time with a new job, kids having to adjust to a new community, and my family responsibilities, I decided I elected not to do it.
And would you make a different decision today?
You know, it's one of those things I wish I would have had the opportunity to do because I love organizational work and I love ASHP. I enjoyed so much my time on the ASHP Foundation Board. In retrospect, I think I would have taken another look at it. From a family standpoint, I think it was the right decision.
Shifting gears a little, in the last several years, you were a significant inpatient. Talk about the insights and how healthcare is delivered from the patient vantage point.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't recommend that route to figure this out, but I can tell you, even when you think you have seen it all and been involved in health system practice for a long time, there's nothing that penetrates your thought process more than laying in a bed for 48 days in an acute care institution. I mean, people don't stay there that many days anymore and live through it usually. So, again, I'm grateful for having lived through that. But also, I did take a lot of mental notes, let me assure you. And some of those that I can think of right off were, first of all, I was at Scott & White, my old hospital. I had left there, but I was actually at Scott & White. And I think the first thing was, I think we have a pretty good program there that we started years ago, but there's still a lot of things could be a lot better. And when you're laying there in the bed in the eyes of the patient, I'd have to say that right off. And again, I think we had a pretty daggone good place to work and a good level of practice. But if I can say that, having been a patient, then I think that's a message for all of us to think about, well, hey, guys, we've done pretty good, but we've got a long ways to go. The other things, I think in a big teaching institution like Scott & White, the transition from team to team, there's an incredible, including the pharmacy clinical team like we had at Scott & White, there's an incredible tendency to drop the ball in between. And so it's real possible to have extremely good super specialists, which in a tertiary care hospital we had. But I saw all the gaps exposed in between. I mean, people would come in just having one team left, another one came on and asked the same questions. And sometimes, you know, that or they didn't ask them and they got it wrong. And so I think that handoff, if you will, between the teams means that everybody needs to be thinking more in terms of how do we link these together, including the pharmacy team. So I think those are two big issues.
You currently teach at your alma mater, the University of Texas at Austin. Why do you teach?
Well, I, again, go back to my answer to your first question about students and residents, and that is, you know, I think it keeps me alive as a practitioner. It keeps me stimulated. I think I have a pretty good message to deliver to students, and I'm very interested, you know, as we get older and can't practice maybe at the same level we did, the ability to pass those messages on and instill in these students, whether it's residents or students or undergraduates or whatever, that message about practice level is extremely important to me. At the same time, the side benefits are, again, I enjoy it, you know, I get stimulated by it, and I feel like it keeps me on the top of my game.
And some years ago, you taught nursing pharmacology. Did you approach that the same way we were taught pharmacology in pharmacy school?
You know, that was about an 8.5-year pathway, too. And again, I sort of did it parallel with what I did with our pharmacy nurses. But it was in the diploma school there at Methodist in Lubbock. And I'd have to say I started out teaching it that way because that's what I knew. And I pretty quickly realized that I was teaching at a much higher level than the average nursing student could really deal with very well, nor needed for that matter. So I pretty much tailored my, over probably the first 2 years, I tailored from teaching what I'd been taught to another version of that, which was scaled down, and then emphasizing more some of the patient care aspects that they needed to link to the drug usage than perhaps what we got in pharmacy. I was also a stickler for math because, you know, we saw so many issues with patient safety, with nurses not knowing calculations very, very well. So I stuck with that, and that was probably my legacy. They all hated me when I got to the math section because even some very good nursing students struggled with the math, and I wouldn't let them off because I felt so strongly about the importance of understanding dosage calculations in the practice setting.
So that's kind of an example of taking into account your audience in terms of how you're going to teach or how you're going to communicate. What do they need?
Absolutely. Trying to figure out, okay, you know, it's one thing to go through the, and there's some really good nursing textbooks out there. And it was a great review for me. One of the reasons I continue to enjoy it because it made me focus on new products in every therapeutic class. But I also realized that a lot of what we were taught simply wasn't needed in the environment. And yet at the same time, there were a lot of things that they needed that we didn't need. And so what I did too, I paralleled that with our pharmacy nurse program and tried to take our nurse training program, the same things I was learning in the diploma school, to take over to them in our training program. And so the net result of that was those 96 pharmacy nurses we had were really skilled clinicians and they knew their pharmacy.
In 2004, you were awarded the prestigious Harvey A.K. Whitney Lecture Award. And with that award comes a lecture. And you gave a very powerful lecture and paper that's been published. Talk a little bit about the essence of your message, because I think it's still very applicable today.
It was called The Discontent of Professionalism. And I wrote it. I was very blessed to get the award, and I was extremely excited to be able to do the lecture. At the same time, as you well know, it's a challenge then to decide what in the heck am I going to say. And having just left my 25-year tenure at Scott & White, I had a lot of things on my mind. So I sort of folded all that practice experience, both as a leader and a practitioner, into, you know, what in the heck could I say that sort of says it all. And after a good bit of thought, it occurred to me that at Scott & White, we had such a broad envelope of patient care responsibilities. In fact, we did a board report where we could show that about every 7 seconds we were touching a patient in our pharmacy practice somewhere. It might be 100 miles away in a retail setting or whatever, including the acute care settings. When you think about that, it's almost frightening. It is frightening to think the potential, just the sheer mathematical probabilities that bad things can happen to patients, even with very good systems. So the thread of the message was that the only way I learned to live with that was to think that I was doing, in my heart of hearts, I was doing everything with my team. And again, a lot of it was done by the team, not me, but the team I was leading, that we were, before we put our head on the pillow at night, we were determined to do everything we could for that patient. And that if we could do that, then we could go to bed and sleep at night and say, well, you know, we've done all we can do. Because there's always a limit in resources, there's a limit in money. But I think that was the thread of that whole lecture. I gave a story at the front end about a pediatric era and how it feels to go through that process. So I think we got their attention with that and then followed up with, hey guys, you know, we can never, ever be content with anything less than our absolute best.
As you think back over your career, what are some lessons that you wish you'd have learned earlier rather than later?
You know, I mentioned that before about round pegs and square holes. I think, if I'd learned that a little earlier, I might have had a little less rocky time from time to time. But I think in that same vein, I think if I earlier on had realized just how critically important the people piece of this puzzle is, I knew it and I kind of learned it because I think I had some instincts for that. But I was so busy looking at systems and clinical practice and sort of the mechanics and the logistics of all that and the money of all that, how do you do this with restricted funds, that I think sometimes I didn't lift the people piece out of it, the leadership people piece out of it, and say this in and of itself is where it all starts. And if it doesn't start there, it doesn't happen in those other areas, whether it's an IV lab that you've created or a diabetic clinic or an OR satellite or a patient care team on a unit. It just doesn't happen without that people thing happening. If I'd have done that earlier, I think the last half of my career, I got that right. I figured it out. The first half of my career, I think I stumbled along from time to time learning the hard way. Again, you can't go do it over again, but in answer to your question, I think the quicker we can come to the reality that we're not a drug product profession, we're a people patient profession. And in order to make that happen, we got to first of all be concerned about that patient and family, and then we got to realize we can't do it all ourselves, so we got to build a team of people capable of taking care of that patient.
As you think back over your career, what's brought you the most satisfaction?
You know, I think seeing a clear problem or challenge in seeing a team of people that I can lead and help to fashion a vision and an idea to take it all the way to fruition to say, hey, you know, we did that. It's not perfect, but it's a heck of a lot better than it used to be. I think the other thing is the team itself, seeing young folks and all the team develop and carry that ball at a different level. And some of my greatest pride was seeing the individuals that came in very shy and unwilling to take responsibility and see them come out the other side, being able to not only lead in my department, but go to another institution and do a good job.
How have you benefited from mentors?
Well, again, my early experiences, I described my travels to University of Kentucky and Arkansas and Leo Godley's place at Harris in Fort Worth were all self-created mentors, if you will. I had to go round them up. But from day one, in answer to your first question, how did I come back and figure out what to do first, I went and started building that alliance with people that had notoriety in doing it right. And so out of that, I just continued to build on that. And again, I've been very blessed to be active in organizations and to travel and to speak and get involved. And so in each of those encounters, I've tried to build a relationship that, for example, with you, you know, that I know I can call you and talk to you about an issue. You can do that with me. And that you've got a skill set that's strong in many ways that I don't have. And so it's a selfish thing, but it's also something you have to give away, because if you're going to do that, you're eventually going to be giving it back as well. And so understanding that and being willing and able to do that, and I think listening. I think the other thing is both a mentor as well as the person being mentored requires listening to each other sincerely, openly, and honestly, and then taking that and going fixing whatever issue you have in your own organization.
You have served on editorial boards for the American Journal of Health System Pharmacy and Hospital Pharmacy. What are the roles of editorial boards?
Well, you know, I was involved both with AJHP as well as with Lippincott's Hospital Pharmacy for a lot of years, the Lippincott job. And what we did was essentially advise the content and the direction of the publication, as well as review individual articles and presentations. And again, it was another way to stay very connected with the people that were making a difference around the country in both AJHP and Lippincott's. And again, usually able to interact. I formed another network of colleagues as well as mentors through those relationships as well.
To write and publish takes some time. Why should somebody do that?
Well, it's kind of the same answer as the teaching and mentoring thing. I think, you know, in fact, I tell our students at UT this. I think there are three levels of leadership responsibility. First of all, you got to lead yourself in terms of what you believe and how you practice and keeping your act together. You know, the second thing is you got to learn how to lead a team of people. And then to your question, the third is societal leadership. By that, I mean whether it's giving a talk at the local civic club or church, or whether it's being president of a state society or a board member of ASHP, as well as writing articles and doing present. I mean, that's all work. But again, I think it's part of it's the third rail of our responsibility as practitioners and leaders. And again, I believe that from day one. But I think you have to set that as a priority, because all of us have busy professional lives, busy personal lives. And if you don't sort of day one, and again, that's what I tell our students at UT, you set that as one of three things you've simply got to do.
Well, and I know I benefited, and I'm sure you did, from what people before us had published.
Absolutely. If they hadn't done that, we wouldn't have been able to do a lot of what we've been able to do.
Yeah, so it is the giving back
exactly.
Concept.
Exactly.
Several years ago, you were a co-author on a publication on high-performance pharmacies. Talk a little bit about what a high-performance pharmacy is and what that's all about.
All right. Yeah, that's an interesting project, and it's still very readily available on the website. If you Google high-performance pharmacy, you'll find this real quick, and you can get a lot of information. But this was a group that actually started out as some of us as individuals, and it sort of got institutionalized into a formal group of individual practitioners and leaders who got together and looked at, okay, guys, what does it take to run a high-performance pharmacy? Because, again, I think most of us were in very high-pressure, tenuous situations, oftentimes financially and operationally. And in the years of my practice, we've gone from running a simple drug room to a very big, complicated clinical organization and with millions of dollars involved. And so we look around, and if we're really going to pass this on, we have to, first of all, define what it is that a high-performance pharmacy is. So what this does, and again, I recommend people looking at it, there are actually eight areas that it identifies as essential pieces of that puzzle, if you will, that every good high-performance pharmacy has to address. And then each of those, it actually goes through and defines and subdefines the questions you need to ask yourself and the issues that you need to address in order to come up to speed with those eight essential areas.
And as I remember, those are sort of competencies, leadership competencies.
It's a series of competencies as well as sort of fundamental practice questions that you ask yourself. It's not that different in some ways with some of the practice surveys we do. If you think about some of the practice surveys ASHP's done, where we sort of survey ourselves to decide, same way with ISMP, where we survey ourselves and decide how are we doing. It's a similar thing to that, except it's a very much a global leadership thing of how do you run a high-performance department. And again, it's great, great stuff. I recommend it.
Billy, as a faculty member with the Pharmacy Leadership Academy, you and Sharon Murphy Enright teach the Getting Results. Talk about what is the material in that module.
Yeah, Sharon and I have done this from the beginning of the PLA, and we kind of continue to modify it. So I, again, recommend that people seeing this presentation go to the website, the PLA website, and look at the resources. But what we essentially did, this is the last of the modules, the nine modules, and we actually try to pull together the learning systems and thought processes that the other modules have done for leadership, pull those into a final module, if you will, that looks at how do you pull all these pieces together and what do you do with it. And so the net result is getting results. So again, we go into practical case studies, we have conference calls, and we put students to doing various exercises as well as a rather lengthy list of books and articles that we have them read that all relate to, when it's all said and done, how do you make this produce results? Which after all, if the PLA and the experience of going through the PLA is going to really engender any results, it's going to have to allow us to figure out how to do that.
Is this something that comes natural to pharmacists, getting results?
You know, I think in some sense it is, and in another sense we're like everybody else in the world. I think we struggle sometimes with bringing things to fruition. And so, you know, we oftentimes get caught in the milieu of detail, particularly I think we're detail people. And so I'm not sure it comes any more natural or less natural to us than any other profession. But it certainly, if you look at results across the spectrum, it seems to be some individuals have that ability and that innate knowledge and understanding. Others don't. I think we're in that same category, so we need some help to look at, okay, these guys are doing it well. What in the heck did they do to make it happen?
Billy, thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you.